Привіт!
Привіт! Це подкаст «Коли все має значення» і я Наталка Гуменюк.
А я Ангеліна Карякіна, і ми сьогодні говоримо про незвичайне знайомство Наталки з деякими людьми в Болгарії і про її враження від нещодавної поїздки. Наталко, ти щойно з Софії. Розкажи, будь ласка, що ти там робила?
Це такий несподіваний випуск подкасту, дійсно, з Болгарії, бо якось я не мала якихось глибоких відносин з цією країною. І я записала розмову з одним з сьогодні найвідомішим болгарським театральним режисером Галіном Стоєвим, який є директором театру в Тулузі, одним з найкращих театрів у Франції, національних театрів. Але він поставив в національному народному театрі Софії, головному театрі Болгарії, виставу «Гаага» про трибунал над Путіним і його клікою. І ніби звучить це якби щось таке, як звичайне, але якщо уявити сьогоднішню Європу і головний театр якоїсь з європейських країн, ніде більше така вистава не йде. Якби сам факт в тому, що в Болгарії, яка вважається не такою аж проукраїнською, як нам би хотілося, саме там іде ця вистава, яку я побачила, і мене вона просто надзвичайно вразила. Ось тому я вирішила якби швидко встигнути і з Галіном поспілкуватися.
Скажи, будь ласка, Галін виключно режисер? Тобто це п'єса була написана теж болгарським автором? Чи це тільки вистава болгарська?
Ця вистава була написана українською драматургиною Сашою Денисовою. Вона працювала певний час в Москві. Вона вихованка театру ДОК, документального театру, але, звісно, залишила давно Росію. Але що особливого, що сам Галін, він після 24 лютого сказав, що він відкрив собі особливу злість після того, що сталося, і він мав бажання зробити якусь виставу. І він запитував, хто є з українських драматургів. Він почав цікавитися українським театром, щоб знайти можливість співпраці з українським драматургом. І так зустрів Сашу, дізнався, що в неї є така ідея, і фактично вони вже допрацьовували цю виставу разом. Саша ставила цю виставу на маленькій сцені в Познані, але це така була, скажімо так, проба, так? Але ось велика масштабна вистава на сцені великого театру, народного театру з головною трупою країни. Такого немає. Ця вистава, вона відбувається в уяві дівчинки, батьки якої загинули в Маріуполі. Саме тому, як він пояснює, він міг дозволити собі більше, да, придумувати будь-які сцени, тому що ця вистава в уяві. В ній відповідачами виступають Путін, Шойгу, Пригожин, Ковальчук, Матвієнко, Маргарита Сіманяни, Рамзан Кадиров, а також Патрушев, очільник ФСБ. Вони є героями, але там вплітаються дуже акуратно історії, скажімо, трагічні, так? Це сатирична вистава, вона дуже гротескна, але я насправді не усвідомлювала, наскільки, виявляється, вона могла би бути суперечливою для Болгарії. Там був, наприклад, випадок, коли один з акторів відмовився виконувати роль Патрушева, тому що боявся, що його отруять новічком. Що мені здалося дуже цікавим, навіть там, будучи українкою, наскільки вона детальна, наскільки вона відповідає фактажу того, що відбувалося. Умовно кажучи, там є деталі від бойових гусей, про яких говорить Патрушев, до, скажімо, навіть якщо це трагічні сцени, я, як українка, я вгадувала якісь деталі, що ось це є інтерв'ю жінки з Бучі, яке я чула. Ось це там цитата суду над Шишимаріним, першим російським воєнним, якого засудили в Україні. Цитати там Сіманян чи когось ще, вони реальні просто на самій сцені. Ось цього театру, вони виглядають максимально абсурдними. Ти розумієш, що саме там їм місце. Той абсурд і маразм, який вони говорять, з якого ти потім розумієш, що ти можеш якби сміятися. Так? Він показує болгарській аудиторії, як навіть самими їхніми словами, скажімо, так, вони самі стають собі вироком, просто говорячи те, що вони говорять. Хоча велика кількість тексту, та, вона зібрана з реального життя.
Як так вдалося, що ти потрапила на цю виставу? Ну, тобто, я так розумію, це співпадіння. Це ж там кілька днів вона може йти, і ти в ці дні в Софії. Тобто, ти була там на місці. Розкажи, взагалі, як болгари приймали цю виставу? Чи був повний зал? І наскільки розуміли, Ну, я маю на увазі, наскільки зал відчував взагалі, про що йдеться, як приймав цю виставу?
Я приїхала в Софію давати щорічну лекцію пам'яті Джу Юлії Гурковської. Юлія Гурковська була відомою яхтсменкою, яка досі з чоловіком тримає рекорди того, як вони на рятувальному човні долали в 70-80-ті океани. Це була таке подружжя рок-зірок, скажімо, для Болгарії, але вона стала потім керівницею апарату Желько Желєва, першого демократичного президента Болгарії, і однією з керівників Центру ліберальних стратегій в Софії, такого антианалітичного центру. І довкола цього центру гуртувалося інтелектуальне життя Болгарії. Я читала лекцію, і тому дуже багато людей з цього середовища, в тому числі там і сам Галін Стоєв, який приїхав в Софію, і решта людей, вони були там, вони були на моїй лекції. Потім дійсно виявилося, що на наступний день субота була тим, що називається довгим днем театру. Це день театру, коли вистави тривають, можуть тривати цілу ніч, коли після вистав є дискусії. Це дійсно збіг, мені дуже пощастило, що в той самий час приїхав з Франції Галін в Софію. Мені було дуже цікаво зрозуміти, як болгари переживають через те, що ось в них, скажімо, те, що вони кажуть, немає консенсусу в суспільстві, що є якась умовна альтернативна точка зору на Росію. І вони, але в той же час я побачила, яка велика частина, якби також ось цього інтелектуального середовища Болгарії підтримує Україну, наскільки глибоко, як багато вони розмірковують, вони працюють над тим, щоб якось щось було інакше. Я хочу додати, в той же час в них проєвропейський уряд. Ця держава надає Україні потрібну зброю, дизель. Ця держава приймає дуже багато українських біженців, але в них все дійсно є велика кількість проросійське налаштованого суспільства. Це дуже багатьох обурює, для них це біль. У самого Галіна батьки вчилися в Росії. Коли він подзвонив батькам 24 лютого, мама сказала, нічого, зараз звільнять Україну від нацистів. Він потім довго з ними не спілкувався, але фактично ця вистава це також супротив проти його ж батьків. Да, він хотів їм довести. І батьки, до речі, були на виставі, потім розкажу про їхні враження, воно вже в інтерв'ю. Я просто розуміла, що ця вистава дійсно зроблена для аудиторії, яка сумнівається. Це дуже дивно. Тобто вона зроблена не просто для таких, як я, хто просто подивиться і посміється над Путіним і зрозуміє, як це якби все жахливо, і зрозуміє важливість. Вона дійсно якось так зроблена, що вони самі себе дискредитують тим, що вони говорять. Правда направлена на те, щоб змінити думку людей. Не просто переконати європейців в тому, що Путін поганий. А в ній є якісь моменти, коли видно, що вона зачіпає щось, щоб людина, там той самий, та сама людина в Болгарії, яка там згадувала радянське якесь там минуле соціалістичне, і згадувала, що щось так не було погано, і Росія завжди була другом, починала сумніватися. Да? Акторка, яка грає Матвієнко, вона говорить там: от раніше були там репресії, зате не було депресії. Вони працюють саме на цих людей, на таких людей, як там мама Галіна і інших. І мені здається, що є тоді в цьому випадку якась особливість. І ми навіть коли думали, я потім брала участь, там була дискусія з акторами після, я, звісно, хотіла висловитися, подякувати їм. От що треба ще уявити для себе? Він їх змусив всіх читати телеграм-канали, слідкувати, бо, тут в Україні ніхто не всі можуть знати, який є Ковальчук чи там, ладно, Пригожина знають. Всі ці актори в цю роль увійшли. Це доволі велика трупа. Це найкращі актори країни. І мені здалося, що це такий теж громадянський вчинок. По суті, Галін своєю виставою змінив головну трупу болгарського народного театру. Зігравши таку виставу, ти якось розумієш, що є частинка тепер болгарського суспільства, яка відома, яка популярна, яка точно інакше і глибше дивиться на цю війну. Тобто вони стали в якомусь випадку такими амбасадорами підтримки України. на відміну від якби того просто, що вони грали. Вистава має аншлаг. Я була там, не було жодного місця, і мені сказали, що там вона йде там тричі на місяць, з вересня, весь час зала повна. Було кілька українців на виставі, які потім могли змогу поставити свої запитання, але це все-таки насамперед болгарська публіка. Притом я теж побачила з запитань, що там дійсно серед цієї публіки були і ті люди, які сумніваються.
Отже, розмова Наталки Гуменюк з болгарським режисером Галіном Стоєвим. Давайте слухати.
So first, I definitely would start that, like, I'm absolutely impressed by the performance. Again, we will get further to that, but for me as a Ukrainian, I couldn't, of course, watch it as a just theater play, because not just we recognize politicians and the Russian politicians, but everybody knows them. They're still for you a bit like TV figures and real people, but I really had a strong connection and understanding that the survivors and the Ukrainians, like, portrayed in the play are also like the real people, which you recognize from meeting even them. Like, so they are not just the people whom you saw on the television. Tell a bit more about this play.
This play is, on one hand, not at all unusual, because you should treat it as any theater play. On another hand, this play is so directly connected with what's going on right now that it rises the level of danger somehow, the level of provocation, especially when you place it in a society, in a context where the positions are not very clear. The society feels a bit lost, because we even had politicians on high positions in this country who are working on promoting the so-called aggressor's attitude. And I think that it's usual in most of the post-communist countries from the bloc. The play is situated in a space where you could still pretend you're doing art, but actually you're expressing a very strong citizenship attitude somehow.
How did you get into making it?
After 24th of February last year, I, like many other theater makers, realized that I know nothing about Ukrainian theater, or almost nothing. So I started asking and looking around and reading and being more focused on this. And the name of Sasha Denisova came a couple of times from different sites, from different people who don't know each other. I figured out that she's in Warsaw. I took the plane, I went there, I met her. I saw a work she did with some refugees in the refugees camps there. And then we sort of started communicating. She sent me some of her text. But I figured out that we knew the same people. She did some important part of her career in Moscow, in Theater Doc. And she was developing already this idea of documentary theater. She told me, I want to write about The Hague. And I thought that it was a great, really a great idea. I talked to my good friend Ivan Vorypaev, who is a playwright originally from Russia. He has a Polish citizenship now. He left Russia 15 years ago, and he cannot go back to Russia because he's an enemy. He told me, oh, Sasha got this really brilliant idea. I'm jealous. I would have written something about this, though being Russian, I'm not sure I'm legitimate to do it right now. But then Sasha made her performance, she staged it in Poznan. And I went again, I saw the show there with Polish actors. I read the play in Russian. And then getting out of the theater, I said, I have to do this play immediately. The question was whether I would do it in France or in Bulgaria. From the anthropological point of view, doing it in Bulgaria is much more interesting and much more experimental. Exactly, because this is one of the rare cases where you could experience theater on a much deeper level. It's not just an aesthetic sort of experience, but I could see by the quality of the silence in the hall when people are watching now, by the involvement they experience, that theater actually could really, in exceptional cases like this one, could touch a very deep levels of the society mindsets. sort of rearrange them somehow on the intimate level. And then I called the National Theatre here and I said, guys, I have a project for you if you want me to do something, but we have to do it right now, immediately. So if you have to change your program, you have to clear up space so I can rehearse, et cetera, et cetera. For me, it was interesting as well whether such a heavy and big institution like the National Theatre in Sofia will go for such a project, because we don't really have here a very strong political theater experience in this country. And I myself, I've never done political theater before. It was a risky experiment. I thought it would be a kamikaze project somehow in this context, but I couldn't look at myself in the mirror if I would have not done this show here.
Maybe you can a bit elaborate more on how you found yourself also on the February 24th, 2022, with your background, you know. So what it was for you, this invasion, and where did you live?
I am originally Bulgarian. My parents are Bulgarians, but my father did his studies in Moscow. I was very young at that point. I was three when we moved to Moscow, and at the age of seven, we went back to Bulgaria. But practically, I started speaking first Russian and then Bulgarian. And then when we came back to Bulgaria, I studied in all the possible Russian schools because I spoke already the language. This gave me the chance to know the Russian classical sort of culture a bit better than the average Bulgarian. And then I grew up in Bulgaria. I did my studies in Bulgaria. My career started immediately after the Berlin Wall came down. So that was the moment my generation could start travel and explore everything which was forbidden just 15 minutes ago. I started my career very early here in Bulgaria, and then I started traveling. I've been working in different places, in different countries. I ended up in France, where today I'm the artistic director of Théâtre National de Toulouse, which is one of the biggest theater in the country. I'm a bit of a particular case because I don't really have a place where I could say I'm rooted, really. I had this identity crisis for a long time, not knowing where I belong to, actually. And then I realized that probably I don't belong anywhere, but my role should be to create bridges and create connections between different contexts, between different cultural approaches, between different ideas of what is theater and how you should do it. So I found myself in this position. And the moment I wasn't living really in Bulgaria, which is like probably almost 20 years now, I started coming back to Bulgaria more often and often and being much more interested in what's going on in the country once I'm not there, and started feeling some kind of responsibility towards this context somehow, which is a paradoxical thing as well. Just before 24th February last year, I was in Poland to meet some colleagues, and I spent some time with my friend Ivan Vorepaev, and we were talking a lot about what's going on, and he was explaining to me till the last moment that there won't be any war, because economically speaking, it's illogical to go for such a thing, and not even from the point of view of ideology, just economically, it's just completely insane. And then I went back to Toulouse. And on the 24th of February, I woke up and I opened the news and I saw what's going on. So that was my big, big crush, because I experienced a reaction of anger, which I didn't know before that I had in me. It's like you feel angry and you feel powerless somehow to do anything, as if they stole even the possibility to react. I talked to my mom on the phone. She just said one thing. On the phone, she said, oh, don't worry, they will just take the Nazis out and everything will be okay. And that was the big shock for me, because I didn't know actually that my parents would think, or my mom would think something like this. And I was really angry. I was very, very angry against them. And then I realized later that every time I would go there, their television will be on, and they would watch all kinds of Russian channels, which today are banned. But for years and years, actually, this kind of propaganda was brainwashing anybody who would just stand this thing. I felt somehow betrayed. I felt that I really don't belong anywhere if my mother would say such a thing. So it was a really painful experience on a personal level. And I think the idea of make the Hague in Sofia in Bulgaria was as well somehow inspired by this, because I did it. At one point, I even thought of dedicating this show to my parents. Then I said, okay, it's a bit too provocative even for them. But they came to the opening. I invited them. They came, they watched the opening. They were very interested who is playing whom. They never touched the subjects again. No, I didn't talk to them for a year. I couldn't. I really couldn't. And I feel ashamed because of this. But I didn't know what to do. And I still feel ashamed.
But you found out, like, what they told, just not indirectly. So what is, like, still, there is extreme satire in this show. The people they've seen on the television, you know, they're, you know, caricatures of themselves and look horrible. And by the way, when I'm watching, because, you know, your colleagues and friends told me before the play, this relations between your parents, I was thinking all the time that, in fact, you know, it's really like they are speaking for themselves. It's really the play, not for me, made not for me. You know, I don't think there would be a lot of like pro-Russian people in this theater, to be honest, on the first hand. But at the same time, it's made for the people who oddly like either believe or decided to believe. But you really like, you're trying to reach out that side somehow. It's feeling, especially Matviyenko when speaking, it just as if I was thinking like when Matviyenko was speaking, I really thought that probably she was addressing your mom.
Very possible. Very possible. Yeah. Her monologue about how beautiful it was during the socialism was a pure dedication to my mom.
I hope this play, that would be the moment it's also, you know, the Ukrainian audience can see, but I think it's not really the film, so I can do the spoilers. So these kind of phrases that we had repressions, but we didn't have depression, that was like, oh, but even like for us, saying that like, yeah, there was Holodomor, but there was an ice cream for 28 kopeekas. You're like, oh God, like exactly that's it.
Well, but these are very stable attitudes which exist in the society, and people, especially those who are brainwashed by this kind of propaganda, they function in this cognitive dissonance. And they make sort of logical structures, which look like logical structures of the thought, but they're not. They're like completely perverted idea of what logic should be. Through these structures, actually, they create these attitudes, which became more and more stable in the society, as if people were refusing really to think or even to feel.
But in the end, your mother had a chance to talk to the actress who played Valentina Matviyenko.
Yes. My parents talked to them. My parents talked to almost all the actors who play there, because some of them are very famous, so they saw them on the television, and they felt flattered to spend a moment with them. And the actors came afterwards and said, your parents are very proud with you. And I think that if it's true, I think that they probably don't understand me, but that they see that there is all this noise around what I do. And probably there something is happening. But I think for them is as painful as for me is, because nevertheless, I remain their child somehow. They cannot do anything against this.
So the play is about this leadership of Russia who are in The Hague, who are in front of the trial. That's what I thought, that the whole conflict, if you really like take away the realistic part, is really about whose guilt is that? Vladimir Putin or these people? Because they try to make, you know, him responsible, but they are also responsible. Still for you, you know, in this play, who is guilty?
Oh, that's a very big question. Because, yeah, it's a play about the guilt. But who would be charged and who would be held responsible? Who is guilty? I think there is something I might call the collective Putin. It's actually not only one person. Of course, they're all personally guilty, I think. But the guilt goes even further on, because why we talk about Shakespearean approach towards this play? Because what's going on in the reality sometimes goes over all the limits of basic logical comprehension. As one amazing intellectual and dissident said, that sometimes we have a feeling that the reality could be explained only by mythological terms. Terms like evil, good, bad. There is this thing about being so much rooted in the past and functioning with mental structures and thought structures from 500 years ago, trying to explain nowadays and what's going on today. And then there is this big misfit of the thought, as if the thought experiences an accident, a catastrophe, and cannot function anymore. And from there on, actually, the play reveals all kinds of evil facets or evil sides somehow. And how humans, how mortals meet with this evil and start playing with this and start producing a kind of a war, which they imagine like a feast or like a celebration. And this celebration, something which is linked to festivity and to something joyful in our minds, becomes actually fed by pure evil. And this mixture is very theatrical somehow. From this mixture, the theatrical play, the theatrical gaming could come on stage, and it's very tasty for the actors. Though we're all aware that we're touching a pure dark material, and we're almost making some kind of exorcism on stage in order to show to the audience the mechanism, how this contamination happens, and then to talk as well, especially in this context, in front of this society, about our own identity. Because by how we placed ourselves towards what's going on, how we position ourselves, this has a direct impact on our identity. Where do we belong to? Who are we? What are we doing, actually? You know, just by being there, just by observing this thing, just by being against or for this thing, already it makes us involved in the story.
There are numerous, you know, moments, but I like, so for instance, like there was this laughable moment when an actor playing Surkov is kind of persuading Putin to, you know, like to take the guilt and be this, you know, like become this Jesus Christ, get crucified, and that him, you know, Margot Simonyan and the others would be as this prophet. So, you know, like he's kind of pushing Putin, like, take this for us, take this guilt for us, and then you'll be great and you'll be crucified. So that's our way to escape. But it was like this very funny answer of Putin, like, where did you get your cocaine when you were in prison? So there are a lot of like hilarious moments, the way how Prigozhin, Suravikin, and Ramzan Kadyrov are portrayed, or Margarita Simonyan, while, of course, I couldn't, react also on this kind of like tragic moments which were inserted, which are very, you know, which were powerful, but not being able to express, but where to find this, you know, thin line that it's not become kind of vulgar or like, you know, too much or pathetic, really pathetic. Because, you know, there is a comedy and then there is this kid forced by Margarita Simonyan to say how great is Putin, you know, like starts to sing Ukrainian anthem. And, you know, it's becoming very touching. And also, you know, it's hard to portray the... Bucha morgue, or particularly like murder of the husband of a person in Bucha, which probably I know it's Bucha, you know, the audience might not know. How did you work with that? Because when I heard first from the state, I think it was like from Georgi Gospodinov, I think like they were explaining him and his wife on what is this play. They really said like, it's satire. So I expected like satire already. I was ready for that. But, you know, I saw that. How you worked with that? Because it's really not just about the playwriter. It's about the director, how you said it. And, you know, what were also your, you know, precautions while dealing and doing this story through the story of a kid, which, you know, which is a way, it's in a play, right? But it also can be a very banal, you know, way how you can, you know, portray this kid in a different way, the girl who is, you know, is the main narrator.
There are a lot of traps on the way. I think depending on where you do the show, and for whom you do the show, for what kind of audience you do the show. Because, I, of course, I had these difficult questions like whether I'm legitimate to do this. You know, how can I talk about the suffering of people, which suffering I saw only on YouTube or on the television? But then I told myself that there is a very big educational moment in the show in general. Especially in Bulgaria, you need to present this in order to raise the awareness and to give some more practical information, what's going on and who is who actually. Because most people in the audience, they don't know these characters. Yeah, they know Prigozhin, they know Kadyrov probably, but that's it. I don't know how I did it. I was following some kind of very deep instinct in me. And actually, even if it's a show about how a kid would imagine a trial in The Hague, I think this kid was me, or this kid was what I would experience starting from 24th of February last year. And the shock I experienced by feeling all those emotions. For a very long time, I gave a complete freedom to the actors because I didn't know what is the form of this thing. I didn't know what is the genre of this thing because I've never done such a thing and I didn't have examples in front of me. I realized that there is a almost essential logic behind it. The most important thing is not the funny part and then the sad part, but how you could move from one to the other and keep this constant movement from the tragedy and the funny, hilarious moments. And then I thought that this is not a real trial. This is a trial imagined by a kid. And if it happens in the kid's head, everything is open there. Everything is possible because the imagination rules first. Starting from this point, actually, it was very easy because it becomes really Alice in Wonderland journey. But here is Alice in Hellland journey, actually. It's a traveling somehow. It's a trial, but on another hand, it's like a road movie. It's like you're going from one situation to another.
It works because, again, like just seeing the national anthem of the country at war in the middle of like satire show, it should be subtle, and it was. And, you know, I don't know who were the people in the audience. As I understand, like, it's always full house, but there was definitely some Ukrainian lady behind me who was telling, but that's exactly like it is. That's exactly like it is. And I definitely heard her, you know, weeping in moments of this very, very sad parts. There is another thing. I'm actually curious how also the actress changed. You know, wherever you expect, you can't expect the actors in National Bulgarian Theater all of a sudden knew, you know, everything about Suravikin, Prigozhin, Patrushev, Kovalchuk, but they were really so realistic. You know, I Kovalchuk, who knows about Kovalchuk, even in Ukraine, knowing that he's this kind of crazy imperialist, like thinking about Catherine the Great and the Russian Empire and everything. How did you work with the actors? And actually, what is also your observation of the actors and the whole National Theater of Bulgaria after this play?
Actually, the choice of the characters presenting on stage, it's a bit limited. We ask ourselves why Solovyov is not there, why Medvedev is not there. But then I realized that you cannot put all of them because then the cast will be like 30 actors on stage and it's a very expensive thing to produce with so many people. And then I realized that what Sasha Denisova did is she chose key personalities from the political life of Russian Federation who could represent the whole part of this ideological construct which they managed to build up in this last decades in order to justify the aggression. I said, okay, every one of them is charged, every one of these characters is charged by one particular part, which constitutes the whole thing somehow.
So let me then, so that would be, for instance, like Kadyrov, who would be, you know, accused also of like prisoner, torturing the prisoners of war and humiliating them. You know, the Matviyenko and her role in, you know, signing all the papers, Suravikin for the bombardments of, you know, civilians in Mariupol and not like that.
Simonyan for the propaganda.
Prigozhin for...
For Prigozhin. it's enough even it's being enough. Prigozhin.
Shoigu for actually running this war. Kovalchuk for this imperialist mindset and for crazy conspiratorial idea of the West conspiring all that. So yeah, there are all kind of pieces together.
So all this is actually the Putin's aura somehow. You should know that the play as well is a constant deconstruction of all cultural Russian codes from the classical culture. In the beginning, actually, I was absolutely convinced that all the actors should share my attitude and my position without even asking questions. I was like so radical, like Nazi radical, I would say, from my point of view. And then my first shock came when one actor, it was in the moment I was doing the cast and I was meeting different actors and talking with them. One actor refused to play in the thing. He said, I think it's much more complicated. You know, he started with this sort of discourse. And I told him, very good you tell me this, because my position is as clear as a sunny summer day. So we don't have anything to share in this project. So thank you, bye. I had some actors in the cast with whom I've been working before and with whom I'm very close, like the actress who plays Putin. There are other actors, younger actors, whom I didn't know. I've never worked with them. And when I started my first rehearsal, I was really under shock because I realized that they know absolutely nothing or almost nothing about what's going on. Yeah, they know some general information and it ends up there. So I said, okay, I need to start a massive educational program with all these guys. And then at one point I realized that my job is not to convince them to do or to believe in whatever I think they should believe. No. But very quickly, I realized I should not do this. I said to myself, no, I should work on the text as if this is any other theatrical play. I should do anything what Stanislavski taught us to do, analyze the text, work on a dramatic situation, on the conflicts, on the problems in this in the different scenes, etc. So I said, I'm going to do this. And then while doing this, I was providing them of extra information about any of the characters, and especially sharing with them my absolutely childish astonishment of lack of basic logic in what they're doing and what their choices are. I would say it was my soft power on them. And then I figure out that gradually they started getting to these Telegram channels, reading Prigozhin's sort of information, reading Kadyrov, reading about anything. The actress who plays Matviyenko, her partner in life, half of his family is Russian, I think. So he's in a very strong pro-Putin position. But she deals with him in a really funny way. So she never fights with him. She gave him first to read the Patrushev's monologue, who is actually the point of view of Patrushev, really, if you take it out of the context. And he was reading this and he said, yeah, this is exactly like this. And then she brought him to the show. And I think this person was really blown away coming out and saying, yeah, actually, the war is a fucking dirty, awful thing. So you see actually that it's not a question really of convincing them, but it's a question of offering them living experience, which theater could do. Because theater appeals to your capacity of empathy before everything. And there somehow people could still meet, no matter their positioning.
One of the moments when, of course, it was like, you know, kind of lovable, but for me very strong, that was exactly when the, you know, I understand you included some of like Bulgaria, you know, this phrase like "Курица не птица, Болгария не за граница," kind of in particularly for the Bulgarian audience. But what was strong for me also, somebody who, you know, was born in the 80s and watched all the Soviet series when they were, when in this kind of the Hague prisons, the actors were all in this orange robes, the prisoners' robes, and Valentina Matviyenko was a conductor of the choir, and they were singing "Прекрасная далёка, не будь ко мне жестока."
Прекрасная далёка, не будь ко мне жестока, не будь ко мне жестока, жестока.
The song actually from Гости из будущего, like a nice song. You know, how you get it, as again, for me, so what was your thinking? I think I shared it, that was you, that it felt like this kind of, this song like represents like this betrayal, you know, what's happening is like betrayal of your childhood in some way.
To be honest, I'll tell you something I never told anybody. When the war started, I got some moments, I cannot explain why, I probably should talk to a psychologist, but I went on YouTube and I started looking for my old Russian play records with fairy tales I used to listen when I was a kid. Because when we came back from Moscow to Bulgaria, I came with a big pile of long plays, plastink. And I had all kinds of fairy tales there, which I was listening. And I had this urge to go to this childish state when I would listen on this language, and I sort of recreate these moments when I felt happy, or I felt enchanted, or I felt, you know, I came back to the childhood somehow. Because after this war, I knew that I don't have this thing anymore, and I cannot go back there anymore. There is something definitive which happened, and it's tragic, and it doesn't depend on me. But I, as a result, I lose this thing. Old socialistic songs, films, and things started coming back to my head, and then this Prekrasna Daleka suddenly appeared, and I listened to it. And I said, oh my God, in today's context, this song in the Russian culture towards Russian people is probably one of the biggest accusations. Because we all were somehow wanted to be like this little girl from the film, or were in love with this little girl in the film. We all sang this song at one point. And this song is very beautiful because it's a song of someone very pure who hopes that the future will be nice to him and that he will be dignified for this
future.
But you
know, the phrase
somehow
is not exactly, that's what I just got. That it's not like the Prekrasna Daleka would be nice. It's like, не будь ко мне жестока. It's like, what the hell?
As if they knew already what would happen, you know? I started sort of getting these connections in my head. And then I said, oh my God, I have to put this song in the show. Because you could listen to this song and laugh at this thing, and at the same time you can listen to this song and cry at this thing. Because how can you hope for the future not to be cruel, especially when you see what's going on today? All this came together somehow, but I think it was another type of intelligence. It's not me. I'm not neither that sensitive nor that intelligent to figure this out.
Probably I want also to ask you more about this attitude towards the Russian culture, because again, like there are also now the huge, it's not like a conflict, but the big argument also among the Ukrainians and internationals, there are Ukrainians who really like very strongly, you know, trying to, you know, what we call like cancel Russia culture and like put so much, you know, energy just into that, which to my mind, maybe it's sometimes like not exactly the only enemy and like maybe even too much. At the same time, it's true that if wherever you get abroad, the people would say, but this culture of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, that's one thing, but also, you know, why are you Ukrainians taking away the Pushkin statue and things like that? How is it for you? And can you also explain how you see and how also your change attitude for the Russian culture, being Bulgarian with a strong roots to the theater, which is also, you know, like there is a particular tradition of theater in Russia, but also, you know, the role it played for I think like any international playwright and film director, it's like the Chekhov for director of the theater is not Chekhov for somebody who just heard about it somewhere in London.
You know, my previous production before that one was Uncle Vanya. Mm-hmm. And I did it in France, and it was arranged that I would do it long before the war started. I even worked on the new translation from Russian to French of Дядя Ваня. When the war started, no, but the show was already on. So I'm very much connected to this culture, and I know it more or less, I would say. This canceling passion, especially coming from Ukrainians all over the world today, I don't share it, but I perfectly understand it. Because These people come from a deeply traumatic experience, and they have their right on their time for shock, for suffering, for denial of this culture, for like resisting and this thing. On another hand, it's good to remember Anna Arendt, which we someone mentioned yesterday.
Actually, the Ukrainian man who was in the audience in his perfect Russian mentioned Hannah Arendt. She said,
especially when there was this wave of canceling German culture after Second World War, she said, I understand, but the language is not guilty. It's not the fault of the language, somehow, she said. It's a very tricky question. And today, I think there will be this period of denying Russian culture. And I think there will be wave of coming back to this culture differently later.
But look, still in this play, there is a huge part of kind of a bit mocking. So what you wanted to say, you know, what you really wanted to say, because, you know, like in the end, there were all these ridiculous people dancing as a swan lake, you know, so, you know, and it was like a quite a laughable part of the whole play, the kind of working on this kind of the Russians, you know, feeling that great about their culture in their endeavor.
Yes. I would say, if I have to be a bit more precise, I would say that I wasn't really mocking this culture. I was mocking these people who think that this culture is the greatest one, though I'm sure most of them don't have a clue about this culture, or they don't know it. The same as the soldiers who came and who killed all these people in Bucha or elsewhere. I'm not sure they read any Dostoevsky or any Pushkin. But doesn't matter. It's the instrumentalization of culture as a weapon of aggression. I think this is the problematic point. And I think it's not Dostoevsky or Pushkin's or Chekhov's problem. It's Kovalchuk's and Prigozhin's and Simonian problem.
But I would probably add there is something in that more in depth, and I probably would differentiate, you know, like various authors. I had a chat with a soldier who at that point, he's a Ukrainian like left activist, who trade union activist who fought in the war, and we had a chance to talk to him right after he went out from the Bakhmut, from a very difficult battle. It's like looking at as a different person. But he said that, you know, in Bakhmut, I was with us, a journalist from Colombia, I guess, and she asked, like, so what were you reading? You know, were you reading something? He said, like, look, actually, yes, because our Starlink was gone in Bakhmut, and I went to the house just to see some books. We didn't have anything, like, no connection. And then I found this Dostoevsky, Преступление и наказание, The Crime and the Punishment. And then, when I was, like, rereading it, I actually thought that, in fact, this place in Bakhmut, it's like, I really feel for me that it's really, like, so much is about, like, how far can I go in my sin? And this war for me would be, like, how the Russians are saying, how far I can go in my sin? So, you know, there are some things, if you really speak, you know, strongly, you know, there are, of course, the issues that there is a Pushkin portraits and Lermontov in Kherson as the part of claiming their city. And there are unfortunate cases when you would see in the torture cells in Kherson prisons where they kept Ukrainians, you know, like the Lermontov was carved on the wall and the people were forced to read it. So there is, and the whole thing's happening with Mariupol theater, where there are these great faces on the facade of the place of the crime and the place of the incredible tragedy. So it's also like there is something which is instrumentalized, but there is also something in the way which is there, if you really speak about Lermontov and colonial culture in case of the Georgia and the others, which probably I wouldn't think that way. So, you know, it's...
Yeah, but it's not only a Russian sort of phenomena. When the United States of America got in a war with the British Empire at the end of the 19th century, it didn't make them to get down all the Shakespeare monuments in the States. They have some, probably not that much as in Eastern Europe, like in our countries, but they have some. So I think this is an open question. I myself today, I don't touch any Russian literature or anything. I can't, even if I didn't suffer some bombing or some killing around me. It's not so much logical It comes as a, in a feeling from my stomach somehow. But I think it's a big issue, and I think in the years to come it will be dealt with.
I do have the questions more about the like to finalize on Bulgaria and Ukraine as such. But I'm also curious. On this war, something you also told about the, you know, comparing the current Russian state to the Game of Thrones.
Oh yes, this is another thing which I find quite amazing.
Finalize on Bulgaria and Ukraine.
Just the fact
as such.
That you have a country in which a father of the child is in prison because the child made a peace painting at school. And at the same time, we have a character like Prigozhin, who just took part of his army or all his army and went to Moscow, you know, and then freely going from town to town in Moscow without being stopped. These two things together, you cannot put it in one frame only. It's absolutely ridiculous. Then Prigozhin got killed. Then there were these rumors that, yeah, all his people are dead, but actually he's somewhere in South America and he waits the moment to resurrect and reappear again. And then there was this thing about Putin, who is dead or probably not dead, and probably Patrushev is now, you know, the leader of the country. And there is this, how do you say, dvoynik?
Ganger?
Yes, somebody else. All those sort of conspiracy theories going on there, and you watch this almost live online, you know, because the information are circulating very quickly today. And at one point, you watch all this sort of like Balu Satani from Master and Margarita, and you think, okay, but this is actually a real state, you know. It's not a TV Netflix TV series. They have even nuclear weapons. And they behave like medieval fantasy, like Game of Thrones, for instance. Though when you watch Game of Thrones, no matter how violent is like Siri, you never forget that this is an artistic invention somehow, and you can always switch off the television. While here, you have a real country which behaves like an artistic invention. And at the same time, they have like concrete things with which they could destroy not only Ukraine, but the entire planet.
But I remember in the first months of the war, like, it felt like in the movie, but like there were different movies for depending on which, you know, like fan of the movie you are, because for somebody it would be like Lord of the Rings when, you know, like, and then elves came, yes, and then the dwarves came and somebody else, and you fighting this, you know, dark cloud. The others, you would say like, oh no, it's a clearly like the Star Wars, because there is Empire and you're Republic fighting, exactly, striking back. Like Empire strikes back and you're fighting and there is this rebellion. So you really like think, God, like it can't be that much as in the fairy tale. But then when I talked to somebody of the historians and they said like Tolkien, anybody, you know, they wrote that based on the medieval like real stories and actually fairy tales, they were written after the real wars, the real battles, exactly, and real events. So in fact, like this is a kind of a medieval war, and it's you know, so thinking that you're a bit like in a fairy tale, it's not really that crazy. It's kind of a bit more normal than you even think.
Exactly. It's once again, it proves that some things we could explain only by mythological structures, because Tolkien or Star Wars or any kind of saga, they sort of refer to mythology. Because if we go a bit further on, we'll get to the ancient Greeks. And this will be again. But there you will have some gods, the half-gods and mortals. And here, I think the terror of what is going on could be tamed only if you used, at least in the beginning, this mythological or these fairy tale structures in order to explain or to picture what's going on.
And there is one also, you know, if you really speak about metaphors, there is one I particularly like that. I think it was written by one of our Ukrainian like essayists, which is also, it's not my invention, but in the relations of Ukraine and the West and Russia, saying that in this war, you know, it's as if like sometimes the West with all the support, like still the people would think like kind of like, let's give this sacrifice for this dragon, you know, like, and maybe we would give this and it'd be okay. And it's like this long, all-lasting idea that, you know, you give something for the dragon and he would calm down being sleeping. And then if you are said like, and now it's you to sacrifice, so just go and sacrifice yourself, be this sacred thing, which, you know, and then we would have our calm life, you know, somewhere here. And then if you are in this position, and that's how sometimes you feel like, and guys, I don't want to die. I don't want to be the sacrifice in the end, wherever, why I would just follow up and like would be ready to, you know, be thrown to the dragon cave. Of course, I would fight back and would do my best to escape. That's how it feels.
Yes, yes, of course. Beyond the fact that it's a civilizational choice and beyond the fact that Ukraine made its choice and is ready to fight and die for its choice. And as someone said, Ukrainians, they live and fight as if they already died. They don't care whether they will die or not, because as if it was solved for them. And now they have to just do the thing. While Russians are there and they have no fucking clue what they're doing there.
Because we have, you know, for an hour spoken, we've spoken about Russia. I still think like, so what, where is Ukraine for you in following this war? You know, like where are you looking? What are you mentioning? What matters for you?
I think Ukraine nowadays did the impossible. And the impossible for me is to articulate a heroic attitude. I think we live in times where the heroism doesn't exist anymore, or at least we thought this. And suddenly, circumstances made as a nation about which we knew almost nothing, and even there is this attitude, well, there's no such a nation, etc., etc., all the Russian sort of narrative, which was going on for ages and ages here. Suddenly you see, even, I don't know whether Ukraine is nation or not, and I don't give a rat's ass if I see today that a nation is born under my nose, in front of my eyes, and I think this is a miraculous thing. I think these things don't happen in the world anymore, and suddenly, puff, we can see this thing. And I think that Ukraine as well is being sort of part of the Slavonic world, Orthodox, Christian, whatever, you know, all this sort of cultural labeling, which tends to the Russian sort of positioning. And, you know, all this narrative that the West is going to hell, and if something could save the world, this will be the Slavs, you know, what Dostoevsky was saying, you know, their culture. And this is what Russians believe very much. And I think if there is something true in this Dostoevsky's sort of point, is that, yeah, probably Slavs will have the chance to save the world, but this will not be Russians, this will be Ukrainians.
You know, it's a perfect way to end. I still have one question on Bulgaria in particularly, which maybe to explain also to the audience and to the Ukrainians. And by the way, I again, like, want to thank the Bulgaria for all the support which is given, which sometimes it's not very obvious for us, you know, because it's not that much in the public sphere, but with the money, weapon and accepting the refugees. I would kind of explain a lot of sentiment in this deep, long tradition of like the Russians saved us from the Ottomans, and the Ottomans with the ultimate evil because they have different religion. And how to get out of that, to what extent it's true, because you still like think, I still think it's just something so engraved in this society. Even if like, if maybe I'm more tolerant to Islam at 21st century, still like at that time, that Turks, that Ottomans, they were really like the evil.
Yes, this is the official narration for a very long time. Look, I don't know how, but I think we as human beings and we together as society, we need to grow up. We really need to grow up and take responsibility for the freedom which we received like 30 years ago. And I'm not sure that we fought really for this freedom. I think they gave us this freedom just like this. And I think as a society, we were not completely ready. I think that freedom, being free, it's an enormous responsibility, and you have to learn to be responsible, and you have to learn to get the responsibility for what you think, for what you say, and for what you do. And I think Bulgarian society, as many societies, especially in the Eastern Bloc, are learning this thing gradually. We're breaking our nose on every second step, unfortunately, but I think there is some progress, even if it's not enough yet. But I think that small acts like this small show of The Hague or any kind of steps into this direction help the society to get this self-awareness and to assume this responsibility somehow. We have to grow up because there is a work which nobody but you could do. If you don't do it, nobody will do it for you. So guys, move your asses and grow up because otherwise we have no chance.